Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. My guest is David Steinberg. He is the author of a number of books, but the most recent one we're going to talk about today, This Thing We Call Sex. And in this book, his core message is something that is very dear to my heart. Sex is a treasure to be celebrated and so much a path to self-knowledge. And as our mutual friend Michael Castleman says, and it's a blurb in his book, wherever Steinberg ventures, his explorations take us closer to the heart of the thing we call sex. In Steinberg's view, sex is who we are, how we live, how we experience desire, yearning, joy, and life. Welcome to the program once again, David Steinberg.
Hi, Diana. Good to be here with you.
Well, it's good to have you. And I came to your talk on the 2nd of April. It was a workshop book signing sponsored by the Foundation for Sex Positive Culture here in Seattle, and it was great. I learned that this book you've written is a long-awaited collection of writings on sex and gender, and I couldn't put the book down. It's really wonderful. As I told you off the air, I read some new things about sexuality. And for me, after 33 years in the field, that's unusual. So it's just a great book, David.
Well, thank you. Yeah,
I'm
really excited that it came out. You know, for 15 years, I wrote this monthly column called Comes Naturally, and then
yes.
Wrote other articles as well. And when I got a call from this publisher that they were interested in putting some of those writings together, I was excited because I've always wanted to put those writings in book form. So I spent 2 years rewriting. I thought it would be this quick project. I would just throw a bunch of my old writing together, but I actually rewrote just about everything of my old material that was in the book, and then I wrote four new chapters, material that hasn't been published before, included 40 of the fine art sexual photography that I do as well, and I was just delighted with the way they designed the book, the editor and book designer that I was working with. It was a great arrangement.
So This Thing We Call Sex, and the subtitle is A Radically Sensible Look at Sex in America. And boy, is it ever radically sensible. It's a great description. I mean,
yeah, I like that phrase. It's, you know, it's odd that to be sensible about sexuality makes you a radical these days, or not only these days, but in general. And so I stumbled on that phrase, and I thought, yeah, that's what it says, because, you know, I'm not one of those people who sets out to be a radical and shock everybody and blow everybody out of the water. It's not my disposition. It's not the way I lead my life. But the way I lead my life, which to me is just a matter of putting one foot in front of the other about sexual matters, turns out to be unconventional and radical. So kind of despite myself, that's where I find myself.
Yes, and we have a mutual friend in Candida Royale, and she said in an endorsement, we'll talk about her in a moment, but this is what she wrote. This thing we call sex is a fascinating read for people who want intelligence with their sex. Steinberg is unafraid to expose his personal sexual truths while challenging us to face and accept our own. I've already started my list of lucky friends who will be receiving a copy. And I have known Candace, otherwise known as Candida, for, I guess, 30 years now. And not quite, but almost. And you've known her a long time.
Yeah.
And of course, she is the producer and director of films for, really the first on the scene in 1984 of films for couples to watch. So they're erotic films. She prefers not to call them pornography. And we'll come back to Candace in a little bit because we're going to talk about one of your chapters first, and that's Man and Pornography. And then we'll move on to Myths of Monogamy. There is so much in David's book. So, of course, he'll have to come back for part two, and that will occur on May the 12th. So
right.
If you want to get his book, you can go to David Steinberg, Steinberg, dot U.S. It's not .com, but it's dot U.S., correct?
Yes, that's right. And you can order the book directly from me on there on the website, in which case I would, you know, I can sign the copies because I'll be sending them out myself. Or people can also, if they prefer, order the book for a couple dollars cheaper from Amazon because it's on sale there as well, both as a print book and then if you want to get a Kindle version, you know, that's $6.99. You can get that at Amazon as well.
You know, you can get it lots of places. But if they go directly to you, they can get a signed copy.
That's correct.
And I got a signed copy. It was fairly sweet because we have known each other a long time. You wrote, thanks for your support all these years.
Yes, I've known you for a long time now. Yes.
I know.
Right.
And we have, I used to share, and when I was in Palo Alto, I used to share a waiting room with Dr. Marty Klein.
Yes, with also an old friend, right.
An old friend, that's right. So how did this book come about, other than what we've already, you've mentioned, you had this column, Comes Naturally. But can you give us sort of a background of other than that and being approached by a publisher of why you wanted to put this together?
Well, I, you know, when Sarah Martinez is my editor at, and BookTrope is the publishing outfit in Seattle that
yeah.
Got interested in this book, and what Sarah felt and sort of convinced me of was that that the voice that I have about, you know, I think the voice I have about sexuality is different from what other people are saying. When I wrote Comes Naturally, and some of these columns go back into the early 1990s, to my mind, there were not a lot of people speaking about sexual issues in a way that made sense. These days, online and so on, I think there are quite a few people who, you know, have, they're all different from each other, but that have, intelligent, positive attitudes about sexuality, who are not treating sexuality as something to be afraid of, but as something to be celebrated. But they tend to be women and gay men. And what Sarah said
yes.
to me was that, you know, it's unusual for straight men, and I'm 100% straight, but I'm mostly straight.
yeah, one of your chapters reveals a little strain from that mostly straight.
Well, that's true. I'm occasionally sexual with men and more than occasionally sexual with transgender women.
Right. But
which
you're
is a whole
a sexual
story in itself.
You're
but
a sexual
identity. My
adventure.
Basic, you know, my basic, identity, I guess I would say, is as a heterosexual man.
Of course.
And
it
Sarah
is.
Felt that it was important to have heterosexual, you know, a voice from a heterosexual man speaking in this kind of way, progressive way about sexuality. So that was part of what interested me. And then the other part for me, I mean, I wrote 158 columns over 15 years. And, you know, one of the things about having a regular column is how do you keep it from getting stale, from getting boring, and
yes.
At least boring to write, if not to read. And
yes.
Well, you know, if it's not new to me as a writer, you know, I appreciate the work of people who talk about the same issues year in and year out because the issues, you know, often don't change and are still important. The therapists who work with clients year in and year out dealing with the same issues over and over again. And I admire people who can do that. And in some ways, I think maybe they're more useful in the end than what I do. But for me, if...
Stop for a moment. That's not true.
Well,
you know,
we
all contribute in our own way,
yes,
and you
yes.
contribute majorly because you are unique, and you are speaking in a different voice than most do.
Yeah,
and,
thank you. I do feel that what I do is useful, or I wouldn't be doing it. What I'm saying is that people who do that, I think, are doing useful work. But for me,
yeah.
it has to stay fresh, to stay interesting.
Uh-huh.
So when I was writing the columns all the time, it was important. I had many voices. Sometimes I would be an investigative journalist. Sometimes I would be an advocate for some issue that, you know, particularly struck me as being important and was being mistreated by the public or by the press. And often it would be being a storyteller because, I don't know, I like telling stories. And
people like hearing stories.
And people, and I think, I really think in many ways, stories reach people at a different level and maybe, you know, a profound level that's very different from, you know, talking logistically about issues. So I love bringing it down to the personal level. And because my life has, you know, I work for myself. I have always worked for myself. Freelancing and I'm out about my sexual beliefs and my sexual practices to my family, to my parents. Well, my mom's dead now, but my parents when they were both alive, to my son. So I have nothing to be afraid of in terms of letting people know who I am and what I do. And because I've been in the world of sex writers, artists, explorers, I know it's been 40 years now, and I was in the San Francisco Bay Area for most of that time. Well, there've been a lot of interesting things going on, so I got to experience a lot and write about it. So I like mixing it up. You know, sometimes I will really play the role of, a disciplined journalist, and sometimes, I'm just telling a good story about what happened to me on Saturday night. So
that's part of what makes you unique, just a part of what makes you unique.
Let me just mention is,
yes.
I just got off the phone a little bit before I called you with an old friend, and we were talking about the crazier things going on in the world, and you know that was enough to make you pull your hair out. And for me, it's really important to have a sense of humor about things that are going on that would otherwise drive you crazy. I think if you don't have a sense of humor about the bad things going on in the world, the things that you really disagree with, I think you can go nuts. So part of it for me, and to me, a sense of humor does not take away from the seriousness of the issues, that you're addressing. But like storytelling, I think humor is a very powerful way to reach people about important issues. Paul Krasner, who's an old friend, was the editor of The Realist and is a stand-up comic and a satirist in the tradition of Lenny Bruce and Mort Saul, is always like, you got to be able to make jokes about it. And, you know, so a lot of my pieces are at least ironic or humorous, and it's just my personality, and I think it translates into being an accessible way. You know, you don't have to be some intellectual, you don't have to be some professional person in the sexology field to be able to relate to stories, especially if they're told with a sense of humor.
Absolutely, and that is very true. As you, in your book, this thing we call sex, you document the American sexual landscape all the way from teenage sexuality to Viagra, swingers parties to erotic spirituality, to lap dancing to women's sexual liberation. And then, of course, you've got your fine art sexual photography interspersed, at the beginning of each chapter, you've got some of your beautiful photographs And then, of course, you talk about pornography, which we're going to talk about, men and pornography. And in your book, Homophobia, BDSM. So you visit a lot of sexual worlds in your book, and you do it with ease, and yes, with humor. And you're a great observer and sometimes a participant, so that makes the story even more vital.
Yeah,
and,
well,
and fascinating.
Yeah, that is that, you know, that is what I do. And I, you know, I was glad to be able to, I mean, just briefly, 15 years ago, it's a long story, but I stumbled into doing what I call fine art sexual photography, of trying to do photography that captures in a real way the emotional connection between regular people, not glamorous people, not porn people, when they're having sex with each other. And so the issue becomes establishing a trusting relationship with the people that you're photographing so that they are willing to be real with each other while being sexual, while I'm there with my camera. And what started out as an experiment for me kind of took over my life, which is why I stopped writing my columns. And so for 15 years I've photographed now 160 different couples, ranging in age from 19 to 75, people at home being natural about who they are as sexual people. And that's something that I'm continuing to do and, you know, offering as a service to people, the people who are interested. I mean, of course, you have to be willing to be sexual with a third person present.
But right. But some couples have asked you to photograph them.
I mean, yeah. And
they like it. And then it's also it gives them a reminder of what was happening in the moment that was so exquisitely erotic.
Yes, and I tell people, you know, this is the only way you will ever get to see what you look like when you're in the middle of whatever it is that you do when you're being sexual, because looking in the mirror is not it. You have to be not distracted, and you have to have somebody there who captures and freezes the moment with a photograph. So, and the couples that I photographed, you know, I would say, without exception, actually, you know, are always amazed to see who they are and appreciative at having this record of themselves in the middle of this, you know, powerful emotional thing that is such an important part of their lives. So it's great to be able to offer that as a service to people. Previously, I did it mostly for people who wanted their photos published, like I do in this book. But now I'm doing it also for people who just want this as a private record for them, where they, you know, they hire me, they bring me in, we take photographs, and it's only for them.
And it stays private that way.
Right.
But it's a real sensual reminder. You've got to be one of the few people doing this, David.
Well, yeah, there are a few people. I got into this by being an agent, a broker for a magazine in Norway, where I was working with other photographers doing interesting sexual photography. There are some other photographers, but not very many. And I think the way that I do it is different from what other people do, in the sense that I don't pose people, I don't tell them what to do. I try to stay out of their way as much as possible and just let them be myself. So I think that whatever comes out of setting up a photo shoot situation in that way is my own, you know, special addition to what.
And I will tell our listening audience that I saw you at work doing this.
It was either last year
or maybe 2 years ago. You were part of the Foundation for Sex Positive Culture and the Seattle Erotic Art Festival, which we should talk about in a moment. And so it was fascinating to be a voyeur, and I brought my Brian with me, and to see you doing this and to see the couples being sexual. And I think a lot of these couples are a little bit, especially if they have an audience, not your private clients, they're a little bit exhibitionistic, so it probably turns up the volume for them.
Yes, yes.
To have an audience and then to have you taking photos.
Yeah, I started doing those workshops, a number of years ago because, essentially there were other photographers who were talking to me saying, you know, how do you work with couples? How do you get people to be natural? You know, you can see in the photos that these people are not performing. They're not stilted. They're just, in their energy. And, you know, I can talk about that, how I meet with them and talk with them and we get to know each other and they get to trust me and so on. But then, it occurred to me at one point that people would get a lot out of just seeing a session like this happen with a couple that was, you know, uninhibited enough that they didn't mind 20 people standing around the edges watching while all this was going on. So first in Norway, I think, and then various places in the U.S. have done that workshop that you were at where, you know, not only do you get to see a couple being sexual, which is one thing, but you get to see the interaction between the couple and me as a photographer.
You have been deemed for the current Seattle Erotic Art Festival. And I am, by the way, you know this, but the listening audience may not. I'm an art activist for this Seattle Erotic Art Festival. And David is you're a sex master, I think they're calling you.
Yeah, but three years ago, 4 years ago, they established this thing called Masters of Erotic Art, and they wanted.
Okay, that's it.
They wanted to honor people who had made a special contribution to erotic art, and there were five of us initially. I was one of the initial five people, and then every year they add one or two new people to the list. And so, yeah.
So this year, and this year goes from, I think, April 23rd through the 25th?
Yes, Thursday night through Saturday afternoon, right?
Right, and I'll be there with Brian Saturday night. It's an amazing thing. So you're unlikely to visit it if you're not in the Seattle area. But if you are in the Seattle area, you should definitely come to this. It's unique. And
yes, I would say, you know, I've been in a number of shows around the country and in Europe as well. And I would say of all the shows, the Seattle Erotic Art Festival is the best in terms of the art that they show and in terms of the spirit of the event. They have performance events. They have workshops. And they have what I think is consistently the best collection of erotic art, not just photography, but photography, painting, sculptures, fabric art, whatever, that I've seen anywhere. So much of what calls itself erotic art, is not very interesting because it's kind of stylized reproductions of glamorous people in, you know, leather and latex, looking like magazine ads, which is fine. But, you know, after the first 1,000 of those that you see, I think it gets a little repetitious. But so the trick is to find the artists who are doing, interesting new creative work. And year after year, I think every year the Seattle Festival has gotten better, the word has gotten out. More artists are submitting work. One year I was a juror for the show, and we reviewed 1,500 submissions that had, yes, had come in for the show that year.
Interesting. And you told me, because I had you on this program a couple of years ago, and either you told me on the air or off the air, that San Francisco probably couldn't pull off a show like Seattle does because, as I recall our conversation, there were too many egos in San Francisco sort of interplaying. Am I remembering this correctly?
Yeah, I don't know if it was. I mean, you get a bunch of artists together, and there's always a bunch of egos going on. I don't know exactly what it is. I think that the people in Seattle are a really interesting collection in the sense that they have a really good artistic sensibility, but they're also really well organized logistically and really well organized financially. And putting those different qualities together is difficult. Artists don't tend to be organized, and artists certainly don't tend to be good with finances. So You know, we have people, the Center for Sex and Culture in San Francisco does great work, but they just don't have the organization and the network to pull together something on the scale of what Seattle does. And I have thought about taking that on myself as a project and talked with, you know, people I know in,
yes,
in San Francisco, Johnny Blank, who founded Good Vibrations and so on, and we debated it. But, you know, to do that means to not do anything else, basically, for at least a half a dozen people all year. I mean, in Seattle,
right,
as soon as one festival is over, they take a break, and then a month later, they're at work planning the next one. And I just wasn't willing to drop everything else that I was doing. And, you know, as much as I keep my eyes open for somebody else who could do that, there just doesn't seem, I don't really know why, but we don't have anything here that competes with that. There's a guy named Peter Koreshtery who runs art shows now twice a year in San Francisco, which is good because before that we had nothing in San Francisco, but they're not of the quality of what's in Seattle. So, you know, it takes time to build an artistic following. It takes time to build a following in the public, and Seattle's been doing it now for 13 years, and they have, you know, they quite deliberately developed a market, developed an audience of people who understood that collecting erotic art, for example, was a legitimate thing to do. It wasn't a sleazy thing to do.
Yeah.
And promoted that tirelessly year after year to where now, you know, 10,000 people will come during the course of a festival. And, you know, part of it is it's a good party, but every year they sell 25 to 30% of the art on the walls, which is unheard of for any gallery with a short-term show.
Did not know that backstory, or the behind the scenes story.
Yeah, no, they're really
so
great.
They'll sell 25 to 30% of the art.
Yeah, you know, if you have an art show and you sell 10% of your work, you feel like you've done great.
Yeah.
Every year they do that. They have docents who know about the art. They have people who are good at explaining the art to potential buyers, and they've just developed the skills to, you know, to help people find their way to the works in a show that they like, and then to feel like it's really okay to actually buy it and take it home.
Well, I'm going to suggest to the CEEF Seattle Erotic Art Festival people that they take advantage of the archived version of this program, because we're giving really some good commercial commercials for it.
Well, I'm glad to promote them because I think they're doing a good thing.
Me too, and that's why I am an art activist. So let's get back to your book a little bit.
Okay.
The chapter, Man and Pornography, and I love this photograph you took of Christina and Mike. At the beginning of each of your chapters, you've got photographs that you've taken, and she's got her leg on him, and she's got beautiful legs with garter belt and stockings, and he's looking up at her very appreciatively with much desire, and So you talk about, now, of course, you wrote this, and we talked about this off the air, you wrote this first in 1985.
Right.
In the Santa Cruz Express.
Yeah, this is actually the first piece that I ever wrote dealing with sexual issues. It's kind of what got me into the whole business of writing about sexuality.
And yes, and this is a wonderful piece. I'm especially fascinated by your question, what are some of the unresolved sexual issues men address through pornography? And the first one you address is sexual scarcity. Would you please elaborate on that? Because
sure.
I think it's still true. It was true in 1985, and it's still true in 2015.
Yeah, you know, so this is like 30 years ago, right?
And there was
this little newspaper in Santa Cruz, one of the alternative weeklies in Santa Cruz, ran a sex issue or something like that, and so they put out the word, and I threw this piece together just because I thought, you know, with all the talk about pornography, with all the anti-pornography, the people who were objecting to pornography, which included myself. I mean, I've been involved in the feminist men's movement forever. And, you know, the feminist critique of pornography and its slant on who women are and who men are and so on is important in to my eyes.
Yeah.
But what that whole critique seemed to ignore was, you know, if so many men are interested in pornography, or these days, 30 years later, we're not just talking about men anymore now, it's men and women are interested in pornography, it can't be just that all the men in America or the West or whatever, are so screwed up that that they are hating women and using pornography to express their hatred of women. Certainly in my own, you know, I was into porn the same as anybody else, and that's not the emotion that I was coming from. So what I wanted to do was to try to take a look at pornography, not from a judgmental point of view, but just kind of more objectively. And I think this is
as a journalist would do.
Yes, and I think this is true about so many issues around sexuality. Everybody gets so wrapped up in kind of the hysterical emotions that come from the fact that as a culture we've been so confused about sexuality for so long. So whenever it comes up, all kinds of craziness comes out of the woodwork. And from my point of view, you know, as a guy, I just wanted to say, look, what's going on here? And what I saw was, you know, men, now again, this goes back to when pornography was not exclusively, but, you know, let's say 99% the audience was men. And what I saw was that men had a lot of issues, really, either desires or insecurities about themselves as sexual people, and in some way pornography addressed those feelings that they had. And one of the ones that, as you mentioned, was the whole issue of sexual scarcity, right? So the culture is set up, and this goes back to the days before birth control, when you know, women who were sexually active risked becoming pregnant on top of diseases,
right,
and stuff like that.
Right.
And one of the things, you know, I think the most radical change around sexuality in the last 50 years was the advent of popular and accessible birth control.
Absolutely.
So for the first time in human history, it's possible to separate sexual activity, you know, not 100% effectively, but pretty damn effectively, to separate sexual activity from having all these babies showing up that society then has to deal with. Well, that changes the entire ball game. It changes the game around what women can safely pursue in terms of their own desires. It changes the ball game for how men can behave and what men can do. AIDS taught us that there are things to watch out for because diseases come up that then have to be dealt with. But even so, you know, it's not the same as the old days. So the way that sexual behavior was largely controlled previous to birth control, which is still carrying over today, this is something that could take 100 years to change, is that women were told that they were the guardians of purity, that men wanted sex all the time, men were beasts, and women's role in the preservation of morality in society was to resist male sexual desire as best they could, unless they were married and, you know, safely in a context that could deal with children, basically. So what that creates for men is this whole notion of sexual scarcity. And so men, you know, you can argue about whether it's biological or not. To some extent, certainly it is, have a desire for sexuality, and women's job is to say no. So the situation that's set up for men is sex is a scarcity, a scarce commodity, and how do you get some? Well, what pornography offered most consistently in those days, and still it's even more true today, actually, is no, here are images of women who are just dying to have sex. They're dying to have sex with anybody. You don't have to be attractive. You don't have to be wealthy. You don't have to be a nice guy. You don't have to be anything. But, these, you know, so the nymphomaniac thing, you know, writ large or writ small, women full of desire fill the images of pornography. And for men, of course, this was exciting to think about. So that's what, you know, one of the themes that pornography repeated over and over again. And related
and
to
you write a closely related issue is one of rejection, and I really appreciate your quoting Warren Farrell, author of Why Men Are the Way They Are. Now, he wrote... Is he still around, by the way? Do you know?
Right.
Is he around?
I believe so. You know, I used to be friends with him. I've kind of fallen out of touch with him. But, I believe he's still around doing workshops and so on.
So he suggests that men's attempts to deal psychologically with rejection have a lot to do with our need, meaning men, to objectify women, that it is less painful to be rejected by an object than by a thinking, feeling human being. And you write, I think he's right, and I think he's right too.
Well, I think that the rejection issue is certainly huge, and that's the other issue that pornography, you know, hammers home again and again. These are attractive women who aren't going to reject you. And, you know, I grew up 2 years younger than everybody else when I was in high school, and the shortest kid.
You were so
and
smart.
And the nerdiest kid to boot, you know. So I'm aware of carrying around the feeling like nobody's going to want me. So, and I think that a lot of men do that. And because men are set up, as we were talking before, in the role, well, it used to be, hopefully this is, you know, actually in the process of changing, but certainly 30 years ago, men were supposed to be the sexual initiators. And I think for young people today, they would still say that that's true.
Yes,
so being
yes.
the initiator means you're the one who's got to stick his neck on the line to, you know, say you're interested in somebody. And then you hope for the best, but, you know, you're certainly sometimes going to be rejected, and you're going to have to deal with that now. You know, that's part of being an adult and growing up and all of that. So that's it's not like it's supposed to be wine and roses all the time. But the men are out there taking the chances. And if women are set up in the role of being the rejectors a lot, I think this really takes its toll on the men, and the men feel insecure. But we're all taught to feel insecure, women and men. We're taught that we are not attractive, that our bodies are not right. You know, our penises are too small, our breasts are too small, our thighs are too big, our stomachs are too big, our muscles are too small, our hair is the wrong color, or whatever it might be, because in a system that works on selling people products, if people feel insecure about themselves sexually, you can sell them everything from cologne to fancy sports cars to make them feel like they're somehow going to be more attractive. So there's a whole culture that profits off of people feeling bad about themselves sexually. And pornography is just one symptom of that culture. You know, if you set up the system that way, then people are going to have lots of fantasies about a world in which that wasn't so. But, you know, it was always true for women worrying about how they look. Now the guys have to worry about how they look, too, and how you look, how you perform sexually, what you want sexually, if you're doing it right, if you know what you know, all these criteria are up. And And there's a whole world out there designed to make all of us feel like, A, we don't know what we're doing, B, we're not desirable, and C, it's our fault. It's not the culture's fault. And one of the things that I try to talk about so much in my writing is how important it is for people to understand, however confused you are, however confused each of us is about our sexuality, it's not our fault. It's not because we're stupid. It's not because, we're incapable of something. It's because the culture is set up to make everybody feel bad. And once people understand that the fact that everything is screwed up is not their fault, and secondarily, is not the fault of the other gender. You know, for women not to feel like things are screwed up because of men, or for men to feel like things are screwed up because of women, it's much larger than that. Things are screwed up because the sexual culture has been against sex for a very long time, and it's the culture that twists everybody around, and everybody's frustrations and everybody's feelings of inadequacy and everybody's confusion about what do I want and why does that excite me, and oh, I'm a bad person for thinking that, whatever it might be. It's that culture that teaches us to hate who we are and hate our desires. If we're going to be angry, that's where the anger should go, not to the other people that we're interacting with. So that's what I try to emphasize and to get people to say, you know, whatever you want, short of, anything you want that's about consensual sex with adults, with people who can give reasonable consent, is okay. And now in the age of the Internet, to understand that as strange as you think your desires may be, you can go online and find thousands of people like you who are struggling with, God, why do I want to do that? Or why do I want to be sexual with those sorts of people? And because of that, we have the opportunity to accept ourselves. And the more we accept ourselves, the happier we get to be, essentially. And if we feel anger, we can put our anger where it deserves to be rather than expressing it toward basically inappropriate targets.
You express this in such an articulate way, and I'm going to guess that a lot of our listeners are really resonating with your words, because we've had a huge change, of course, with the Internet. But now, as you say, people can say, well, I'm not alone. I have some of these kinky or unusual desires, but I'm not alone, and they can find whatever they want to find. In your chapter on men and pornography, you say, these issues, sexual scarcity, desire for appreciation and reciprocation of desire, and fear of being sexually undesirable are the central forces that draw men to pornography. And of course, that's a great summary that does draw men to pornography.
I hope they come away from the book feeling better about themselves, clearer about themselves, clearer
yes.
about who they are and what they want, and feeling like they're okay, that they're more
wow.
than okay, that they're, you know, that they're good people, and can therefore, you know, embrace the full spectrum of their sexual existence more fully than before. I mean, you know, if there's a purpose to my writing, you know, if I could wave a magic wand, it would be everybody should feel better about themselves and clearer about who they are, where it comes from, if there are confusions, if there are uncertainties, understanding what the roots of those are and being able to move forward. And, you know, as we talked before, some of that comes from analysis, you know, whether it's a journalistic analysis or an academic analysis of what is the nature of this situation, how did it get to be that way. But some of it is just feeling it on a human level, which is where we were talking about storytelling and humor. So all of that, I think, can be healing, and that, you know, we none of us will be free of the harm that was done to all of us growing up in a culture that is so confused about sexuality. We're all scarred by it in the same way we're scarred by racism, sexism, whatever. Whatever's in the culture that is negative and hurtful. We can try to be conscious of it, but we've been absorbing this stuff since before we were verbal. So it's in our bones. And then so you got me. Now what am I going to do about it? Well, it helps to understand it. And then, yes, this will still have an effect on you, but it doesn't have to have a grip on you where...
hold you hostage forever.
Exactly, exactly.
Mm. You also write about pornography, and you quote or you allude to Michael Castleman in his book, and Michael's been on my show a number of times, and his book Sexual Solutions, and his more recent book Great Sex about male sexuality. But he notes how seldom pornography includes any kissing, hand-holding, caressing, massage, reciprocal undressing, tenderness, or discussion of lovemaking preferences.
Right.
And so you write, it's sad that pornography speaks so little about softness, vulnerability, uncertainty, and intimacy, all of which we know are really important. And I know this as a therapist, a relationship and sexuality therapist who's worked for over 30 years in this field, how important all of that is, that so often emotional intimacy needs to precede physical intimacy, and some of these acts of and even arousal preceding desire, it's all kind of under that heading, kissing, hand-holding, caressing.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree with Michael, and the photography that I do is about that. It's like, it's the hottest, wildest, hanging off the ceiling acts that you can perform may be fun, but I think for the most part, what people feel most gratified about from sexuality is the intimacy of the connection with another person. And pornography is not about that. Pornography is about fantasy, which is a different world.
Pornography is about fantasy.
So, those of us who were critical of pornography early on, some of us began to say, doesn't it then fall on our shoulders to come up with something better, to come up with imagery that's better, storytelling that's better, that really talks about intimacy and deep, love and connection between people. So, and, I've tried to do that with my own photography. Some of the books that I've edited, I did a book called Photo Sex, which is all about fine art sexual photography, people photographing sexuality in a fine art, with a fine art sensibility, is trying to put out imagery that is talking about exactly what you said. Because I think in the end, that's what makes people happy in their sex lives. I mean, people may love to have wild adventures, but year after year, what's going to make them happy is being able to be intimate, vulnerable, open to in a situation that's not entirely in their control, where they just open the door and you see what happens next. With a person that they trust and that they really care about. So,
Candida Royale, Candace, was the first female producer, writer, director, after a career as a porn actress. But she was the first on the scene in 1984 with erotic films for couples to watch, where there was a bit of a plot. And I know, because she's a friend of mine, that she used real couples wherever she could.
Yep.
She wanted that kind of emotional connection. And she used good lighting. And I had a friend in Los Angeles when I lived there who was a bit of a, she was sort of funny. She said, my husband thinks I don't understand pornography because I keep fast forwarding to the plot. And that's what Candace has done. She has a plot.
Mm-hmm.
And she, 'cause a lot of women do feel like, well, how come this couple is fucking? Well, because they like each other. They like each other.
Right.
So, that makes a difference. So there have been a lot more women after Candida Royale who got into the business, right?
Yes.
And to make more erotic films with better lighting and plots and no money shots. That would be the man ejaculating on the woman's face. And for most women, that's not a turn-on.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a male porn turn-on, right? So, but Candida Royale never did. She never had any of that. She also tried to hire not only couples but women with natural breasts and men that were not overly endowed. So, she was the first on the scene, as far as I know, who did some of these things. She was a real pioneer.
Yeah, because she recognized early on that women would be interested in sexual entertainment and sexual imagery as well if somebody was producing imagery that was directed toward women.
Yes, and I think she's had a successful career with about 20 films over the years. So
yes.
If people want to find some of her films, they can go to Femme, F-E-M-M-E,
production.
Google that, yeah.
Yeah.
And they can find it. But so, you know, this hour has sped by, and we haven't really gotten to the second chapter that I wanted to discuss. We can begin to discuss it, and then maybe we'll continue the discussion May the 12th, your part two.
Sure.
With me. So it has to do with the myths of monogamy. So shall we begin with that?
Sure, if you like.
Yeah. There's so many chapters in your book that are absolutely fascinating. So myth number one in your chapter about the myths of monogamy is sexual desire for someone other than your mate, this is number one, significant enough that you have a real desire and act on it, there is something morally, ethically, or psychologically wrong with you. And Christopher Ryan, and we both know about him and his book, Sex at Dawn.
Right.
He wrote in Playboy last year, May of last year, he quoted Oscar Wilde, "Marriage is the triumph of imagination over intelligence." And the sort of universal expectation that a happy couple will forsake all others for the rest of their lives.
Well, you know, I think the basic issue with monogamy or non-monogamy, I mean, you know, people, I've been in a number of long-term relationships in the course of my adult life, but it's been a long time since I was in a relationship that was defined as being monogamous. I learned early on that wasn't what interested me, and I wasn't interested in being deceptive with my partner, so, you know, I just put that out there. This is who I am. This is what I want to do if I'm going to be, you know, a primary partner with you. And this was true with my wife, who I married when I was in my 20s, and on through other partners. But I'm not into telling everybody that they shouldn't be monogamous. Some people want to be monogamous, and some people don't.
Whether
you're monogamous or you're not, I think the issue that any couple has to deal with is what happens when somebody feels sexually attracted to somebody other than their partner. And to pretend, the what I called myth of monogamy number one pretends that that just won't happen. If you're with the proper partner, if you're really in love, you'll never be attracted. Neither one of you will ever be attracted to anybody else. Well, you know, that's just not the way it works. I don't think it's the way it works for anybody in this culture or even in other cultures. So the question becomes, okay, how are we going to deal with this, right? It's a question for society, how are we going to deal with it, but it's also a question for each person and each couple. How are we going to deal with it when my partner feels sexually attracted to somebody else, or for some people, it's like even feels emotionally drawn to somebody else? You know, let's assume we're talking about a heterosexual couple. What if the man really feels affection for a woman he's working with, say, on the job? Is that okay? Or are you only supposed to like one person in your life? Let alone, are you only supposed to be sexual with one person in your life? What happens if you are sexually attracted to somebody else? What does that mean? Does that mean that something's wrong? Does that mean that your partner is failing you in some way? Or is that just the natural way that things are? If it's the natural way that things are, what are we going to do about it? Is it okay to talk to your partner about that? Gee, there's this person, and, you know, I just had a dream about her. I just had a dream about him, and it was really exciting. Do I want to act on that? Well, maybe that's something we should talk about. So, and then a couple might decide, or, you know, often individuals decide this themselves because they feel afraid to talk about it with their partner. However you decide to act, you're going to have a problem. You know, I shouldn't call it a problem, but there's going to be complexity. If you decide to be sexual with somebody other than your partner, you've either got to lie about it and keep it a secret, which, I don't even have moral issues about this, but I just have practical issues about it. In my family, we were taught that lying is okay. You know, don't tell your grandma that your mom has cancer because she'll just worry. Why should she worry? So we'll pretend that she doesn't have cancer. That's a kind lie. So I believe that there are kind lies. However, I think that lying really destroys the intimacy in a relationship. So if you're going to be sexual with somebody else and you're going to not be truthful about it, there's going to be negative consequences. If you're not sexual with somebody that you're attracted to, there will also be negative consequences because something in you will resent it, will feel it will set up a different kind of complicating dynamic in your primary relationship. So to my mind, no matter how you deal with it, just the fact that sexual desire and the desire for emotional intimacy as well is not contained within a two-person relationship, there has to be a context, a mechanism to deal with this in a sane way, in a way that ends up with people feeling better and not getting hurt. And the only way to do that is to be honest about it and begin to look at what's going on.
We have to stop because that's the music.
Okay.
But you're coming back.
It sets the context for that, at least.
Yeah, it does. And so when you come back, we will discuss more on this monogamous issue.
Okay.
And many other things, too. Thank you, David, so much. You've been a wonderful guest, as always.
Thanks,
appreciate you.